the second class of our Friday night series on the Gospel of John. I hope you enjoyed the first class. If you weren't here, it's recorded, it's online, and you can catch up with the handout and the audio and video. Of course, Tim's sermon on Sunday was also on the Gospel of John, and all the sermons and the Friday nights for January and February are all going to be from the Gospel of John. And even though we're spending 2 months on it, frankly, as I'm sure you're aware, we're really still skimming the surface in many ways. There's so much depth in this amazing gospel, the great news of the gospel. So we are going to look tonight at mostly chapter 3, but as we go through the chapters and talk about the specific themes and lessons from those chapters, I also want to make sure that each week we have at least some material which is about the bigger picture of the gospel and the message that John is trying to get across. And so, no exception tonight, let's first of all talk about the fact that many people say that the Gospel of John is almost like two books in one. So you have a prologue, which covers the first 19 verses of chapter 1. That gives you the introduction we talked about last week of this big picture of Jesus, the Logos, the Word, who was with God and was God now with us in the flesh and revealing God to the world. So we got that in the first 19 verses. And then we have what's sometimes called the Book of Signs, which you're going to talk a bit more about in a moment. And that's the first 12 chapters or so of the Gospel of John. We've got the signs there. And then the second book is the Book of Glory. So we have the Book of Signs, Jesus revealing himself and what he's like and what his power is. And then the Book of Glory, but we'll talk more about that in a minute. And we should pay attention to these divisions in the book because they're very obvious when you look at it carefully. And if it's there, it must be there for a reason. The Apostle John arranged his material in such a way to bring about a particular message, to give us particular understanding about Jesus. So the first half of the gospel is about the signs, and the second half more about his glory, and then the last chapter is a kind of a wrap-up of the whole thing. And so for the first book, the Book of Signs, so to speak, I think the question is, as we read those first 12 chapters, is what am I learning about the way that Jesus ministered to this world? The second half, the Book of Glory, is less about the way that he interacted with people in the world. It's more about his interactions with his followers and his vision for his followers in the world. But the first 12 chapters are more about how he interacts with people. Nicodemus, the woman at the well, the royal official's son, and the royal official, and the man in John chapter 5, who's been an invalid for so long, and John chapter 9, the man born blind. And we have all these interactions of Jesus with people in his first 12 chapters, and it tells us a lot about how he viewed people and how he viewed his role with people. And as we read that, we need to then be thinking about what does that teach me about how, as a Christ bearer myself, what does that teach me about how to be with people? People that are in some ways famous. Nicodemus was probably a famous person in Israel because Jesus doesn't refer to him as a teacher. In fact, in the Greek it's, you are the teacher of Israel. So he might have been the most prominent scholar of his day. So he's dealing with those people. How does he deal with him? And then, by contrast, in chapter 4, how does he deal with the Samaritan woman who's not even a Jew and has a questionable moral history and would not be talked to by men? And we've got these contrasts all through the book. And this tells us, if we look carefully, as to how Jesus treated them, how we might gain insight and how we treat people, but different people a bit differently because they have different needs. So there's a lot of insight we can gain from that. In the second book, the Book of Glory, so to speak, the question we might be asking ourselves is, in the light of what I've seen in the first part of the Gospel of John, by the way that Jesus ministers to people, how does that make sense of his instructions in the second book, the Book of Glory? Because the Book of Glory is more instructions than it is demonstrating how he lived. So how does that tie together? That would be an interesting Bible study to do. How did his actions in the first part of the Gospel connect with his instructions in the second half of the Gospel? We're not going to go into that detail here tonight, but it's to lay out that the Gospels are so different. Luke is very different from this. But this is here to show us something, and it could be a useful study to do. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the signs. Now, there are said to be seven signs. Any reason why we might have that number of signs? What do you think?
Perfect.
Completeness? Because?
Creation, 7 days.
All right, 7 days, 6 days plus the day of rest. I mean, seven is a symbolic number within Hebraic thought to be a number of completion or fullness. So perhaps that's why Jesus performed seven. It's certainly, I think, why John recorded seven. And we have a number of them, which I think I've put them on the handouts. These are the miraculous signs. There are some other things in John's Gospel which are referred to as signs, but these are the miraculous ones. So we have the changing of water into wine, the healing of the official's son, the healing of the lame man, the feeding of the multitude, the walking on water, the healing of the blind man, and raising of Lazarus. And you'll see they're all in the first 11 chapters. So that is showing you again the actions of Jesus in the first half of the Gospel. And they demonstrate certain things about Jesus. So let's take a minute, to think about these stories, which I expect you know enough about, just to think about it. You can refer to them in the scriptures if you want, but I'm just going to take 1 minute through this. Is what is this telling you about the notable feature? What's the notable feature of these particular miracles? Because they are all a bit different. What's the notable feature and what's the power being displayed? Have a quick think, take a minute, and then we'll see what we've got. What do you notice is the notable feature of each of these signs, and what is the kind of power that's being displayed? So, the changing of the water into wine, what do we get? The notable feature of it is the fact that it's not just wine. I mean, changing water into wine would be, well, somewhat impressive, shall we say. But it's not just wine, is it? It's like the best kind of wine that's possible. I mean, I make wine from wine kits, and I've given you some of it for Christmas, and it looks like no one died, which is an encouragement to me. But I'm always hesitant about giving wine to South Africans, because there's a slightly different standard involved there. I gave some to Stefan Wolmerins, and I said, look, if you don't like it, use it for cooking. I won't be offended. That's okay. But it's not just wine. It's the best wine Jesus is making here. Okay, so what would you say is the area of power here? What's he showing us? What would you say? What's it telling you about Jesus?
Power of a nature.
Power of a nature.
No half measures.
No half measures. I mean, taking it to the highest maximum level possible. There is nothing better that can be made. I would just say it's simply quality. It's like I bring the best. I mean, the fact that it's wine is almost incidental, right? I make the best wine because actually I made wine to start with. I actually made the water that made it and that I turned into wine. I mean, this is Jesus showing his power of bringing the best. I think it's a wonderful thing. What about the healing of the official son in chapter 4? What would you say is the notable feature of that? And what is it telling us about the power of Jesus? What does he have power over?
Yeah. He did it remotely.
That's right. He said, oh, just go home. It'll be fine. We're going to preach on that on Sunday in Lower Early, and we'll come to that. A remote healing. It tells you that he has power over space, the final frontier. Okay. Healing of the lame man in chapter 5. What's the notable feature here, would you say? Story of the healing of the lame man by the pool. Notable feature?
A power of our physiology.
Power over the body? Yeah, that's right. And the notable thing, what are we told that's unusual that we're told in this story? Do you remember in chapter 5? What are we told? There's just a detail, but why are we told? There's a detail in there that you think, why is that detail in there?
Been in Birmingham
38 years. 38 years? Why is he telling us 38 years? I mean, again, isn't a healing amazing? Why do we need to know it's 38 years? That's what's notable about it, and that means he has power over time. It doesn't matter how long you've been stuck or you've been in need of healing. It can be 5 minutes, it can be 50 years. I mean, it doesn't make any difference to the power of Jesus. And that's really important for us, because we sometimes get the feeling like, I've been this way for 20 years, even as a Christian, can I ever change? Well, I mean, maybe the time to change hasn't yet come, but it doesn't mean it can't come. Jesus can heal anything. He can change anything. He's got power over time. What about the feeding of the multitude in chapter 6? What's the notable feature here, and what is the area of power? What would you say? Feeding of the vast crowd, thousands of people.
There's more than enough.
More than enough. Okay, I really like that. I didn't have that down, but I think that's right, and I really like that. I mean, a few loaves, right? He feeds thousands. I mean, for me, it's just about abundance or the fact that it's impossible. I mean, I think some of these things are kind of impossible, but you do sometimes get people get healed, like just it happens, right? I don't know, but it's an abundance, and it shows that he has power over quantity. The walking on water is another impossibility in my mind, and shows us he has power over
nature.
Natural laws mean nothing to him. Again, bearing in mind, what he's saying is, you know the thing about me being the one through whom all things were made? I made the universe, therefore I have control over the physical laws of the universe, and I can suspend them at any time I choose. That's really encouraging to know. He has that. He's demonstrated. He's shown us to eyewitnesses that he has that kind of power. What about the healing of the blind man in chapter 9? What would you say is the notable feature and the area of power? What would you say? The notable feature of the man born, the man who's blind here, and is helped to by Jesus miraculously to see again. What would you say?
He was born blind.
So born blind.
Transformational.
Okay, I think it's just the fact that he's born blind. Again, we're given that detail. A healing of a blind man is amazing, but the fact that he's born blind is noted in the record to show us that even when someone is in that desperate a circumstance, still Jesus has the power and the area of power. Maybe misfortune, just bad luck. I mean, he hadn't really done anything to deserve it, but Jesus has power over things that are just... not anyone's fault, you could say. And the raising of Lazarus in chapter 11, what's the notable feature about this and the area of power that is demonstrated by what Jesus does? What would you say?
He's dead.
Yes. But what's the notable feature about his death, or in this circumstance?
4 days.
4 days, 4 days. And why is that important? Anybody knows?
He would have decomposed, as they said.
Decomposition would have begun, and... There's a Jewish...
Jews believe the soul will have to...
Okay, they believe the soul hung around for 3 days. But after the fourth day, it was gone. That was it. So that's one of the reasons, maybe more than one reason, but one of the reasons Jesus waits. Or it's more specifically, God gets him to wait. God doesn't send him until the fourth day. And therefore, we see that the notable feature is that it's 4 days and Jesus has even power over death. I mean, solid death, not just a kind of a death, but an absolute, complete death. So John sees all these things not just as miracles, he sees them as signs of who Jesus really is. What's really going on here? Signs of an underlying reality as to the identity of Jesus that is not obvious to most people because they are willfully blind in the language of John's gospel, light and sight and that kind of thing. The miracle, I'm quoting here from a book, the miracle, and these miracles are not merely beneficial acts, not just done out of compassion, although of course they are done out of compassion, but they're not just done to make someone feel a bit better for a period of time. The miracle has not achieved its goal unless it stimulates belief among the witnesses and leads them to recognize God at work in and revealing God's self through Jesus. That's the point of a sign. That it stimulates belief and a recognition that God is revealing himself through Jesus and what he is doing. Now let's have a look at the flip side of this, at having the signs and the miracles, at the humanity of Jesus. Because the Gospel of John wonderfully balances and blends these two parts of Jesus, his miraculous power and his total humanity. Now his humanity is shown in the passages that I think I've put on the handout. We see at least five ways of describing or showing that Jesus certainly is as human as you or I. In chapter 11, we have him weeping at the tomb of Lazarus. He feels grief and he expresses grief. in chapter 4, when he goes to the well, he is tired. And tired as he was from the journey, he sits down. He knows our fatigue that we feel, sometimes even on a Friday night. He knows that feeling we have. He knows the feeling of anguish. In chapter 12, he says, "My soul is troubled. Save me from this hour, Father." Well, no. And then chapter 13, it says Jesus was troubled in his spirit. You know, that sense of, I don't believe Jesus was sinfully anxious, but I think there was that kind of stirring. You know, when something just hits your heart, perhaps a bit of bad news just knocks you back and you feel that pit in your stomach. Jesus felt that kind of thing. He had the same experiences as you or I. Irritation. I must admit, Penny and I were talking about this the other day. As we get older, I think we get more irritable. I mean, I do. Maybe you don't. But I think she and I were talking about how we both seem to be getting more irritable as we get older. I don't know if it's because we got more aches and pains or whether we just now understand exactly how the world is supposed to be run and why won't people do it the way that we know it should be done or something like that. I don't know, but we do struggle with this. But it's interesting that just being irritated isn't sinful. Jesus got a bit irritated. You see that in the other Gospels, perhaps even more than in John, I think. But we do get it in the passages that I've put up there. I think he's irritated with his mother for asking him to help with the wine. I mean, why are you bothering me? You know, leave me alone. It's not my time. And chapter 6, he tells the group, "You're looking for me not because you saw the signs I performed, but because you ate your loaves and had your fill. You're only here because you've got a full stomach." I mean, that's a bit irritating if you're the Son of God performing miracles and the only reason they're there is for a meal. Chapter 7, "My time is not yet here. For you, any time will do." That's about his brothers. And chapter 8, we'll skip over those for now. So I do believe he gets irritated. And he has a sense of healthy suspicion, people's motives, right? In chapter 2, Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all people. He did not need any testimony about mankind, for he knew what was in each person. I mean, he had that healthy sense of, I know what people are really about. So we feel that from time to time. Why do we need to see the humanity of Jesus? Because he's not just an otherworldly miracle worker. He's not just some, like, a being from another planet that doesn't understand us and our life situation. He's connected with our lives. He understands our situations. And this is very important because when we teach the Bible to people who don't yet know Jesus, you often find that the people you're teaching have a better appreciation for one aspect of Jesus' nature than the other. So maybe they're prepared to accept Jesus as the Son of God and a powerful miracle worker, but they don't connect with him humanly speaking because they don't really believe in his humanity. They don't understand it. Or on the other side, sometimes you meet people who are very willing and find it easy to connect with Jesus as a human, but find it difficult to see him as divine. I think it's really important for us that when we study the Bible with people, we think about where they're at on that spectrum. Because then we will need to adjust our teaching to emphasize the aspect of the nature of Jesus, which is different from the one that they find easiest to accept. So think about the people you know, the people you reach out to. Do they need to have a better illustration of the humanity of Jesus or a better understanding of the deity and the power of Jesus? Think about your Bible studies and the things you might share with them that might help them with that, because they need both, as we all do. Now, we've looked at the signs, we've looked at the humanity of Jesus. Let's have a closer look for a couple of points in John chapter 3, which is really our focus in a way for tonight. So what do we have here? The focus so far, after the prologue, the first 19 verses, is about responses to Jesus. At the end of chapter 1, we have the first apostles beginning to follow Jesus. Then we have the Pharisees arguing. Then we have John the Baptizer, which we'll talk more about, and Nicodemus, the teacher of Israel. And soon in chapter 4, we're going to have the Samaritan woman and the royal official, which we'll be talking about on Sunday. So it's about reactions to Jesus. And chapter 3 shows us two particularly well-known, I think, and famous reactions. First of all, Nicodemus. And there are two themes I pick up particularly from John chapter 3. Two. There are many, but at least two. The first is that new life is available. Not just salvation, but a new life. And in fact, I would say that a new life is more, is deeper and more meaningful than simply salvation. We're being offered a new life because we're offered a new birth. And a new birth is a new life. So we're being offered a new life. And secondly, I think what we're seeing in chapter 3 is that Jesus is the hero. Let's keep him the hero. Let's talk about those two things in the little time that we have left here. Firstly, new life. New life is the first part of chapter 3. We won't read the whole of this section because I'm sure we do know it. But Nicodemus comes to Jesus. He comes to Jesus at night. By the way, any ideas why he might come at night? Why might Nicodemus be coming to Jesus at night?
Is there a secret?
He doesn't want other Pharisees finding out?
Yeah.
Okay, it could be difficult at the Pharisees' coffee morning the next day. All right, yes. Any other reasons why he might come at night?
Well, he's supposed to kind of know it all.
He doesn't want his ignorance to be exposed in front of other people, maybe. That can be embarrassing when it's obvious to other people you've reached the limits of your understanding and you're having a conversation and you can't sustain it any longer. Okay, yeah. Any other reasons? Maybe he's not sure.
Didn't want other people to overhear his personal issues, sort of thing. He
wants to keep it private. Wants to keep it private. And another reason. Go on.
That was a new type of sort of a strange type of teaching, and then he, in chapter 2, he's just been to the temple, turned the tables around, so he's a new type of teaching, more radical, as opposed to what they were teaching. So, I think probably that's why he went secretly to Jesus.
Maybe, you see, I mean, we've got a lot of different things shifting around at the moment, and it's not clear where it's going. I have another theory as to why. I mean, this is a photograph of my prayer time yesterday morning. So I go out early in the morning into the woods, and it's so dark. You know the kind of dark where you're not quite sure where you're putting your feet, right? And I quite like that. I quite like being somewhere where no one's watching me. No one's around, and I can just feel I can be more myself. And so I took a photograph of my prayer spot, just for your benefit. And as you can see, it's very dark. And maybe for Nicodemus, he felt secure in the dark. And maybe he felt like, this is the only time I can get Jesus on his own. He's got crowds around him the rest of the time. I need a personal conversation with Jesus. Which I think is actually quite impressive in a way. I mean, maybe it was fear. Maybe it was a strategic decision to make sure that he could have a focused, deep conversation with Jesus. We don't know. We'll have to ask him one day, assuming he made it to the next life. And I think he may well have done, from what we read. But anyway, we'll see. Now, what do we have? We'll talk about here for a second. This new life, it's introduced in chapter 1, when we're told that this is what Jesus has come to bring in verses 12 and 13. This new life, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born of not of natural descent, nor of human decision, or of a husband's will, but born of God. And then in chapter 3, we have to be born again to, as Jesus tells Nicodemus, to they won't see the kingdom of God unless they're born again. And of course, he doesn't understand that. But he says, no, you must be born of water and the Spirit. Flesh gives birth to flesh, fine. The Spirit gives birth to Spirit, so you shouldn't be surprised at what I'm telling you. This new life is on offer. The opportunity for a second birth means that the problems associated with our first birth do not need to trap us. We're not chained by our previous life. We are affected by it in many different ways, but we're not trapped by what has happened in our past. And that's very important for us in terms of before we were Christians. But it's also still important for us, even the experiences that we have as Christians. We're not stuck. We have a new life, and that new life continues to be renewed in us by the Spirit within us, giving us fresh hope. Old habits and old patterns of thinking and old actions that aren't healthy can be changed. Those patterns can be broken. And that we help each other with that. As part of our community work together. As a chap called De Silva said, the new birth and a new life require a new family, and only the church can provide that. That's what we are. We are a new family for those who have had and are enjoying a new life. Yes, in some ways we're structured, in some ways we're organized, in some ways we have a calendar. But the point is that we're here to support each other in this new life. Because this is how we develop, along with the Holy Spirit, these new ways of living that make a difference in the way we live in this world as well. We are a community of like-minded people working together in the endeavor to be this new family. And John chapters 13 to 17 will expound upon the teachings, the instructions for that, but we'll come to that when we get a bit further on in the gospel. And it reminds me of our theme scripture for the year, Ephesians 2. We are no longer foreigners and strangers, but fellow citizens with God's people and members of his household, built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, with Christ Jesus himself as the chief cornerstone. In him, the whole building is joined together, rises to become a temple, a holy temple in the Lord. And in him, you too are being built together to become a dwelling in which God lives by his Spirit. I mean, this is God's vision for the church, for the newborn people with their new life together, building something amazing like this. And we will talk more about that when we get to John chapter 17, but we'll have to move on for now. So what about Jesus as the hero? This is the John the Baptist section at the end of chapter 3. And some people go John's been baptizing. Jesus has been baptizing, which is interesting. I wonder if you got baptized by Jesus, whether you'd feel especially holy. Your baptism, I'm sure, was great, but mine, I don't know quite how that works. But anyway, he's been baptizing in verse 22. John the Baptist is baptizing somewhere else. They're in different areas. And an argument goes on between John's disciples and the Jew about some ceremonial washing. And then they're saying, look, this other guy's baptizing. What do you think about that? Everyone's going to him. Isn't John's response so impressive? Is he says, he must become greater. I must become less. I mean, John the Baptist was the most famous prophet of his day. In fact, when we read Josephus, other writings from the latter part of the first century, we find that John the Baptist was still more famous than Jesus after Jesus' resurrection. Because you've got to bear in mind, Jesus' resurrection had a big impact on a certain segment of society. But for the population at large, most people never heard of this Jesus or heard of his resurrection. So, but John the Baptist, everybody had heard of, and he was more famous than Jesus till probably at least 80 AD or something around that time. And John's like, I don't care how famous I am. I don't care how big the crowds have been. I don't care the fact they're leaving me. All my Twitter followers are unsubscribing and leaving. My Facebook page is dwindling and I'm being unliked. And you know, if I get someone coming off my feed, I feel it a bit. But John's like, take them all away. He must become greater. Now, what an incredible thing for us to think about the fact that it's about Jesus. You see, John has that understanding. He's the hero, and I want him to be the hero. I want you to know that I want him to be the hero. He must become greater. I must become less. There are still disciples of John the Baptist in Acts 19, if you want to look that up another time. I mean, there are followers of John the Baptist many years later. He's so famous, but he's not looking for him to be the focus. He sees Jesus as the hero. A quick few thoughts for us to take away and think about. How do we keep Jesus as our hero? I'd say, first of all, we celebrate other people's victories, especially when their victories are victories we would like to have had but haven't had. Someone meets someone who becomes a Christian. We celebrate with them and for them, even if it's been a long time for us. We celebrate with them. Someone's child becomes a Christian. Ours are not. Mine are not. We celebrate with them. We rejoice with those who rejoice, and we mourn with those who mourn. But we celebrate others' victories wholeheartedly. Someone gets a job, we're still made redundant, haven't got a job, we still celebrate with them. We celebrate other people's victories. Secondly, we refuse to entertain gossip. John the Baptist would not hear a bad word said about Jesus. We don't entertain gossip. Thirdly, we assume the best of others. I'm sure John the Baptist didn't know everything Jesus was doing, but he assumed the best. We assume the best of others. Fourthly, we pray to discern the hand of God. It was clear to John the Baptist that this was a movement of God that Jesus was involved in, and he had a part in it, but the hero was Jesus. And finally, soberly, we do our part and concern ourselves fully with that. If I'm concerned with my part and doing my part, and if other people are doing other things, that's great, that's fine. But that's not my part. I just need to do my part, right? And an awful lot of relationship issues and church politics is dealt with if we soberly do our part and don't worry about everybody else doing theirs. Let's just do our part and do it well. And let God be glorified. I think this is so important. And there's more we can say, but we're running out of time. So let's just finish off with a couple of other thoughts here. The spirit of John the Baptist. I need it. We all need it. We need it as a church. It's not about which church is doing better, by the way. It's about us doing our part where we are. We got plenty to do where we are. Let's just focus on our work and not worry about other people's. Is Jesus your hero? And are you pointing people to him? Not to yourself, to your family group, to your church, to your whatever, your ideas. Jesus is the hero. He must remain the hero. We must point to him with our life and our words. So it'll be important for us to think about what stood out from the lesson tonight, from these chapters. What stood out to you and I, as we've talked about the power of Jesus displayed in his signs, his humanity displayed in his expression of his feelings, the new life that's on offer that means that the old ways can change to Christ-like ways, and the fact that we do have a hero to worship, and he is worthy of our worship, no one else, and certainly not ourselves. So if we keep Jesus as our hero, we can hold him up as an inspirational model to one another and to the world that needs to see Jesus more clearly, amongst many other things. So between now and Sunday, can I encourage us to read John chapter 4, which will be the focus of the sermons on Sunday. Have a look at that, think about what it means, and then we'll look at that. Talk about what you've heard here tonight with each other, because the more we talk about it with each other, the more it solidifies what we're thinking and helps us to hear other people's ideas as well. And ask God to reveal to you, what is he trying to get you to focus on during this John series? Pray to discern the movement of his spirit in you so that you will know what he wants you to learn from this. Because I expect what you're meant to learn is different from what I'm meant to learn. And when you take time to reflect and pray, to hear God's voice, to be able to know what his intention is with all of this material. I hope that's helpful. We'll have class 3 next week. Thank you very much. Take care.